Well, I was fortunately, you have to fight for freedom. You know, I had to fight to overcome my own inability and gain ability to express myself so I would have a voice, so I could be free in that sense, give myself, for me, it was giving myself a life. It was free from, I was seeking free from despair.
Welcome to episode 114 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. What's up, everybody? What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Bass Shed Podcast. I had taken a little break from doing the podcast. Gigs were pretty busy. Had some stuff going on in my personal life. But now we're back. Actually, this weekend, on the gig topic, this past weekend was a couple kind of, you know, surreal gigs. What was it? Last Wednesday, Trey Cool, the drummer of Green Day, was at the gig and sat in on some tunes. So I got to play with him. That was pretty surreal. Trey was... It was great hang. He was very complimentary of my playing. That was a lot of fun. A few days later, I had a great opportunity to play for the President of the United States. You know, I got to meet him. I can't say me and Biden hung, but it was a cool experience. Obviously, the band I was playing with, we got our picture taken with them. Yeah, the headliner at the event was Lenny Kravitz. And Trombone Shorty was playing with Kravitz. So while we were doing the jazz thing up front, you know, like Trombone Shorty's sitting right there, just checking it out. That was pretty cool. Jerry Jamont is on the episode. I originally met Jerry through session legend David Hood from the Swampers down in Muscle Shoals. After I did the podcast interview with David Hood, he asked me if I wanted Jamont's number, and I'm like, yes, absolutely. You know, right at, when I got done with the talk with David Hood, I text Jerry Jamont. That was a pretty surreal moment. Kind of, Jerry and I would text back and forth, always trying to figure out a time to do the podcast interview. I hadn't heard from him in quite some months, and then he texted me a link to his new autobiography titled Make It Happen, The Life and Times of the Groove Master, bassist Jerry Jamont. And I'm like, man, yeah, come on the podcast. Let's talk about it. You know, great to hear from you. Let's definitely talk about the book. So we did that. I think that was probably early September, maybe even earlier. I can't remember. But I hadn't read the book yet, you know. And so I remember in that first interview, Jerry just kept saying, man, you got to read the book. I'm like, all right, dude. All right. Let me read the book. Through getting to know Jerry and, you know, I can safely say I'm friends with Jerry Jamont now. And that's still surreal to me. We did a masterclass at Lemur Music in late September, where Jerry did the masterclass and book signing event. You can all check that out online at the Bass Shed Academy. .org. I have it up in its entirety there. It's three different videos, but it is an unedited experience of what happened at Lemur Music. So you can go check that out. Jerry and I are also doing another masterclass December 16th at the Bass Exchange Amp Shop in North Hollywood, California. So if you are in the Los Angeles area and you would like to attend a Jerry Jamont masterclass, we will be at the Amp Shop Bass Exchange in NoHo, December 16th, starting at 1 p.m. and ending at 3. It's a two-hour event. You can get tickets to it at thebassshedacademy.org. Jerry Jamont, legend. Aretha Franklin, B.B. King, Nina Simone, The Rascals, Duane Allman. Man, the list goes on and on. I first got hip to him, you know, as a bass player and as a historical presence because of his when he interviewed Jaco. That's how I got hip to him. And then I started researching him a little bit. And then when the Fly Trio record came out in 2004, Larry Grenadier wrote a tune titled JJ about Jerry Jamont. that kind of made me give Jerry another look and started really checking him out even more. And man, his bass lines are so fantastic. He's such a cultural icon, right? All the music he was a part of had this message of freedom, and it was about liberation, and he was a part of that music. And it's, you know, not only a bass legend, but I honestly regard him as a cultural icon. Jerry and I talk about that. We talk about the activism element of the music he was a part of. We talk about his autobiography. You can find that on Amazon. If you're attending the book signing event, you can also pick up a copy there, and Jerry will personally autograph a copy for you. Wonderful, wonderful talk. Jerry and I have had some hangs. We went out to a jazz festival in Watts. Had just a beautiful time hanging out. I remember we ran into bassist Reggie Hamilton down there. It's been an honor to get to know Jerry and absorb his humanity, and how that relates to his playing and how he locks in with tunes and what he's trying to convey to tunes and how where he goes to create bass lines. It all comes from this place of liberation and freedom. It's nothing short of inspiring. Again, the masterclass is December 16th at the Bass Exchange Amp Shop in North Hollywood, from 1 to 3. Stop by the bassshedacademy.org for tickets to that event, and also check out the event that was held at Lemur Music in late September. Here's my talk now with the legendary Jerry Jamon. Jerry, how you doing, man? How you doing?
I'm doing great today, Ryan. Everything is moving along.
That's cool. That's cool. What are you up to? Like, what did you do today? You know, like, I know a lot of stuff that you have going on, which we'll talk about. But, like, what's your day? What'd you do?
Besides my morning, you know, ritual of prayer in the morning. Cooked breakfast for my wife. And
nice.
Got prepared to have this great talk with you today, basically.
Cool.
This was cooling up, you know, smoothing off some rough edges of my presentation.
Yeah. Man, let's talk about the book, because you and I kind of reconnected when you texted me a link to the book. So let's talk about the book.
All right.
How long did it take you to compile it into a book form? Like, it's your autobiography, and you're talking about all things from your childhood into your session playing in New York and all that. But how long did it take you to put all that together?
Once I've committed myself to doing it, it was it took 2 years altogether.
Okay.
To from start to finish, and then there was the process of getting it, finding a publisher for it.
Right.
And we went I picked up a ghostwriter, an editor in the process, and that helped facilitate the whole thing and made it move a lot smoother to come to a conclusion, because it was never ending.
Right. Yeah.
But you still, it's kind of hard to stop and finish it. So I was able to like organize it. And once that occurred, it took basically 5 years to come to the conclusion that we're going to have to do this ourselves, because nobody wants to print the story.
Oh, really? You had it finished for 5 years before it was released?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And I did basically modified it to maybe two different publishers we were pursuing. Mm-hmm. It might be, because when you write a book, sometimes the publisher will want to have it geared towards their way of thinking, their way of their style of publication. A whole lot of things go into a creative project when you have a publisher oversee your work, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of script and guide what's going to happen and what audience is going to be for, basically, and try to custom to their specifications. So we went the academic route. We tried that route. We tried the biographical route, and nothing seemed to fly. So we decided to do it ourselves.
Good.
And I'm glad we did. And we were encouraged along the way by everybody I knew that said, Jerry, you know, let's put it, do it yourself. Don't worry about getting the publisher. People want to hear your story. You're not a household name, but you have a, still have a great story. So, and I've been great, very influential in terms of music, both as a musician, as an activist. So it's time to tell it and get it out there, and hopefully we'll bring other people into the fold.
Yeah,
make them aware of what's going on.
Yeah, something about what you just said I want to talk about. But you, I think one time when we were just hanging, you told me this story about the photo that's on the cover of the book. And I want to make sure that this story comes out because I thought the story was hilarious. I'll let you tell it. But to set it up, I think if I remember correctly, you were on an Aretha session when that picture was taken.
That's right.
And although you have, it's going to be, I think, I hope, kind of an iconic photo of you because it's on the cover of the book. You have a cigarette in your mouth. You, in fact, were not smoking at the time.
I just recently quit about a year ago, prior to that.
Before the picture, yeah.
And before the picture, and because, you know, you're hanging out with your friends and everybody was, we had, hadn't seen each other in a while. I hadn't seen King Curtis in a while. And I had been working with Aretha. We have a recording with her. And we were socializing and they started smoking cigarettes. And so I decided to join them.
Yeah.
And after I joined them, I stepped down with my bass and snap, snap, picked up. So I was busted.
Yeah. Yeah. Boom.
And when the rest came out, I didn't smoke after that. And about a few months later, after the record came out, you know, I said, oh man, gosh.
Yeah. The one time, right?
Yeah, one time, yeah, you know, I got busted. So I was already, you know, I didn't smoke anymore that day. That was that one cigarette I had in the whole year, you know. But after that, I stayed clean for 19 years. What can I tell you?
Yeah, good on you, man. Good on you.
It's a hard habit to break, you know, once that's you start. I feel for people who, like, you know, who have it and can't shake it. It's hard.
That it is. What I want to talk to you about a second that you just mentioned was your work as an activist. Now, so much of that music you were a part of during that time was the music to a movement. I mean, it's always funny. Like, how did you, let me figure out a good way to ask this question. You knew what you were doing. So I don't want to ask the question, did you know what you were doing while you were doing it? I feel like everybody, you knew more than anybody what that movement was about. And what that music represented for the community.
Yes.
How much was the activism portion of it discussed while doing some of these sessions? Was that discussed a lot? Was that just kind of understood?
It was more or less really, really understood by just the nature of being a creative musician. Coming from a jazz perspective, you want to bring the music to life.
Right.
So whatever, no matter what the music was or what the title of the song was, I'd have to paint the picture in my own head to symbolize it musically. And so it was pretty obvious what was going on. And if you're hearing it, besides the title, once you hear the lyric that tells the story, you can't help but understand what it's about. And then you become engaged in a way that no other way could you become engaged as opposed to somebody writing out something for you to play.
Right.
That idea of it, that's a good start. There was a chord structure. There were sometimes notes, sometimes figures. In the case of something like Attica Blues, it was a massive chart written, great ensemble of musicians. And we all fell into knowing what was just transpired. The title told us what to do, basically.
Yeah.
The emotions we're going to... You're going to hear the lyrics. So basically, if you're hearing words all the time, you know what to do. It's almost, there's nothing to be discussed because the message is in the music. It's, it's right there. There's nothing to suggest that we're going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the case. When Aretha did Think, I heard her cry for help and what she was going to cry for freedom and being abused historically. And you hear it just coming out in the lyrics and you want to get with that feeling and support that feeling to bring that music to life.
Yeah.
So it was pretty, for me, it's very easy for me to work that way with that in mind. It was good to have help with something written out, you know, basically to give you a guide. Basically.
Sure. You're right. And I know I've heard you speak just one-on-one, and then even when we did the masterclass at Lemur, freedom has always been a reoccurring theme in the music you were involved with, and that was always a big, that word, that idea, that characteristic was always a huge influence and inspiration for how you would approach so many of these bass lines.
Isn't that something?
That's really fantastic.
But you know, it's what everybody from every ant, from every microbe, from every living species. This is something that we all strive for and need. You know, plants need room to grow.
Sure.
People need room to thrive and to thrive, and people need room to exist.
Yeah.
Freedom is a universally known quest that we all have to strive for, and we all at some point are it's taken away from us.
Mm-hmm.
When we're babies, we don't have the freedom to do what we want to do because we'd be harmful to ourselves. So our freedom is denied. You know, so we're constantly seeking to push through from the very beginning to become free from something.
Mm-hmm.
Free from the suffering, the pain of living, freedom from suffering. You never have freedom from death.
No.
But then again, there's no such thing as death because life is eternal. You're here.
I mean, I think that there's, on the topic of freedom, there's different layers. There's social, maybe economic, you know, things like this. There's
mm-hmm.
within every facet of life, there's a pursuit to freedom. Do you feel that?
Yes.
Let's start with musically. Do you feel that musically do you feel as if through your career and through your playing and through being a part of this music that you found a sense of musical freedom to have your own identity and be free to do that?
Well, I was fortunately, you have to fight for freedom. You know, mm-hmm. I had to fight to overcome my own inability and a gain ability to express myself so I would have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
So I could be free in that sense, give myself, for me, it was giving myself a life. It was free from, I was seeking free from despair,
mm-hmm.
Freedom from paranoia,
right.
Freedom from insecurity. Mm-hmm. All these things I was able to get away from through music.
Sure.
So it's a constant, you know, it's always, that's a great question you asked. It's ongoing.
Yeah.
You know?
No,
I have to become free from my own, the things that might be pulling me down. I have to give my free from the things, the shackles.
Yeah.
That bind me now in my eternal life. There's always something that you have to become free yourself from.
I forgot where we were going. I think it's when we were going to the jazz festival in Watts. My God, I had been reading your book, and I let you know that I loved starting to read the book because I could see myself in your story. And there's nothing more, I think, validating to me than being able to be like, oh, these things that I've thought, that I'm aware of within myself, that someone else has encountered, you know, it validates my story to hear it from someone else.
Yes.
So I thought, the book is fantastic because so many of us will probably be able to hear our story in your story and see our story in your story. Two different mm-hmm. degrees, right? I didn't.
mm-hmm.
I didn't
certainly,
grow up as
certainly.
I didn't grow up as a black child in New York, so I don't have that part.
Right,
but there's other things you struggled with. And I know we've talked about this too. Like, you and I are both kind of dyslexic with numbers. You know, that's something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I know I am, but I don't really talk about it much. I'm not ashamed of it. It's just something I have to deal with. If I'm memorizing a phone number, I don't memorize the phone number. I have to write it down and, you know, on my hand mm-hmm. or something. So, because I know I won't remember it properly. It's just
and write it down in the right order.
Yeah. Right. No, I have to write it down and then like triple check to make sure I'm right. Numbers are a thing.
That last number will invariably become the first number. I've taught myself so many times. I mean, I know this is going to happen. It's predictable.
Man, this made me think of you the other day. I don't know what I was doing. I had like one of those four-digit codes you have to plug in to like after they verify your account or something. They text you the code.
Yeah.
And the code was like, I don't know, 6721. I just started with a 4. I'm like, I don't even know where the 4 came from. And I spent 20 minutes looking like, where the hell did I come up with this 4? And I'm like, oh, I gotta tell Jerry this story. He'll think this is hilarious. The 4 just came out of nowhere.
It looks kind of like a 6, you know. Like, you
know, you can, I don't know how. You know? I don't even know what happened.
It happens, man. It happens. Man, it's the sound of the word 4 might have been in your head. I mean, and it then translates to a number. I mean, it could have been something you saw. I mean, it's just incredible how the mind cross-referencing. It's a good example of the mind cross-referencing what's it's exposed to. And whenever you put credence on it and attach yourself to it, it becomes a real thought. Mm. Now, something that you saw made you think of 4.
Right.
And you had to express it.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of things we don't always express everything we see and everything we feel.
Sure.
We hold a lot of things in. And a lot of things we don't even, you know, even doesn't even matter. We see it, doesn't matter. It doesn't enter into what we're doing.
Right.
It's not a part of our journey, so to speak.
And now, I've never thought about it in that way, but I definitely know that playing is where I get a lot of that stuff out. Mm. You know, like all this stuff that's just in there, you know, that's just kind of rattling around, clutter in the basement, so to speak, sometimes. It comes out when I play. Is that part of your process, too, to purge a lot of that?
Well, I don't know if it's purging. It's like it feels so good to just to be able to manipulate and reconstruct and deconstruct an idea.
Yeah, that's true.
And play it so many different ways and express it so many different ways and do it at the drop of a hat and do it in front of a live audience wherever it's going to be recorded. You're making music is such a... I guess it's life affirming, it's life giving, it's a shared experience that between the person making the music and the ultimately somebody's going to hear this, or I can't wait for somebody to hear this. Mm-hmm. This sounds great, you know, at least it sounds good to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't always translate to sounding so good with somebody else, but yeah, then you have to manipulate it and reconstruct it so that it does fit into whatever's going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or write things around it so that it makes it sound good, basically. I mean, that's part of the process. And even that is a challenge. Come up with an idea and then make it sound good. Make it right.
Sure.
Make it fit. Just like my things with colors. Like, you know, you have like, okay, you take two colors that look, you know, that look crazy together, but this basically musically, they might sound cool. Well, maybe not. We'll make that right. You might want to stretch the terms of how far it is from each other. Once you do that, everything sounds good.
I mean, I think then what someone would have to confront is the idea of perspective. Like, what sounds right? If you're going for perfect harmonious thing where it's a, like, let's mm-hmm. say a note and then a perfect fifth above that note, okay, well, that's harmonious. Mm-hmm. If that's what you mm-hmm. want, cool. If that's not what you want, do a half step above. If you want that clash and that tension, it's a matter of perspective of what right is.
Exactly. Well, it's really the perspective of the purpose of why you're making the music determines whether it's right or wrong.
Correct.
I mean that's like, you know, that kind of makes sense. You know, if it fits the occasion, in other words, if it's tasty, it's right.
Yeah,
if it's tasteful,
I mean, all you got to do is dress for the weather.
It's
you know what I mean? You just got to dress for the weather. That's all it comes down to.
Exactly.
How did that prepare for
whatever's coming.
How did that impact when you think about the idea of freedom? And the idea of freedom has inspired so many of your bass lines, your legendary bass lines. How did the color system kind of come into play there? Or what would you go, what sounds made or were associated with freedom for you?
Well, actually, when I was making those records, I wasn't thinking about colors.
Okay.
In fact, well, the colors came out of, actually, the colors came out of a result of working with a musician, great singer, Laura Nero. Mm-hmm. And she would tell us, myself and whoever else, I mean, this is the way she would express herself with musicians.
Okay.
She would say, could you put a little blue on this, or put a little pink on this part, or a little green, whatever color she had thought of necessary to get the mood that she was looking for. She would say that, and we would do something in our mind, think that way, mindful of that when we make it playing our part, and we adjust it with that in mind. And a few times, and she'd say, "Okay, that's enough. That's good. That's good. That's it."
Okay.
And so that was the only time in those during those eras in that era when I was making music where I used colors. And that's what made spark the idea when Herb Lavelle mentioned that, brought that to my attention 20 years later, after the fact, the time that we were working with her to change my numeric system into a color sound music system. I said, okay, this is viable because we've experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I can see. It's so funny. I was playing around this today, thinking about playing, just making a modulation from a one color, one key to another, and using the color as a way of modulating, you know. Okay, what's the fifth of the next key? Mm-hmm. Oh, the fifth's going to be red. Okay, there it is. We're going to key of F.
Yeah.
Going to green. And so I was able to, you know, throw it in just like that. So there are many uses of it that I haven't really delved into it myself, but I know for people of a younger generation, people just coming into this world, babies, infants, people who have attention deficit disorders, a way of tracking, bringing back memories to them. I think it's a very viable way, another tool in the toolbox to help us become more productive and creative, and to unlock the talents that we might have that we never otherwise might not experience. It's almost like learning another language in a sense,
mm-hmm.
In the interpretation of hearing music that way.
Yeah, and you and I have discussed this. You have an organization kind of set up about this called Solar Energy, and it is about associating pitches to specific colors and kind of I forgot how we spoke of it last week when we were on the phone, but it was like demystifying or taking all the academics kind of out of the challenge of learning music and just making it more simple, more feeling based, and more visual.
Yes, yes. That was, in fact, that was a supposition that Herb said. He would say, suppose you can learn music without the tedium of going through, does C-sharp sound good with B-flat, and does F-sharp sound good with A-flat, basically, and what these things meant. And let's look in terms of, can you make that simplify and just make it colors and go from there? And it does do that. Mm-hmm. It does do that. And if it beyond doing that, it gives people a way to enter into music from a very simple method, a mm-hmm. Very, very basic platform. Kind of like levels the playing field in terms of, oh, this blue is G, and this F is F, this G, this green is F, and this yellow is E. All these things, it's like training the brain to think another way. It's another layer of productivity for your neurons in your brain to work. And they like to work. You know, they like to be given work to do. And the more they exercise, just like the muscles in your body, they get bigger and stronger. And they want more challenges. So this is another way of actually challenging the brain and helping the brain to challenge it to do even more.
Now, I would like you to speak to this. What color is B flat? Let me start here. We're gonna for this question and this conversation, we're gonna use B flat. What color is B flat?
Oh, that's pink.
Pink, okay. What how did B flat become pink? Like why not B flat as like a light blue or some other kind of maybe infant color that's light? Why pink?
Mm-hmm. Why blue?
No, why pink?
Why pink?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Why pink? Because first, pink was not one of the colors that was designated by Pythagoras more than 3,000 years ago. He came up with the original system, and he only used the rainbow colors, which were red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet.
Yeah.
So B flat is a color, is a note that we all play, tone that we all play, that's in the 12-tone scale. That wasn't accounted for. So I have to basically designate those five, we call them accidental notes, key notes, and give them color sound names. And I chose pink because it's something that we all see in our world, that we all we thought speak, come out of pink, out of the womb, pink, our insides, our internals are pink. Mm-hmm. The other colors of brown is something that we see on the earth. We see it in our skin color. We see it in things of our choice, leather. We see the other color of gold. It's something that's a mineral that we value, mm-hmm. that we revere, and that's prevalent in our choice of things that we do. Then we have silver, which is another valuable element, mineral that we live with. You can look at that as gray. And then we have turquoise, which is the color of sounding like a mixture of green and blue. Mm-hmm. So these are things, the colors that we actually live with that were necessary to account for the five accidentals that we use anyway. So I had to basically just go with my gut feeling of what we live with. Yeah. And make it something more holistic that we know that man can vibrate to in our world as opposed to looking up at the heavens. Let's talk about what's going on down here. Mm-hmm. So it brings into play that thinking also.
Now when Pythagoras put together this number, or excuse me, this color system associated with the rainbow and how it relates to tonal music, you have seven colors of the rainbow and seven mm-hmm. scale degrees. So did each color get a separate scale degree? You know, yes. If you're in C, then C, I mean, I'm just starting from the top of the rainbow and all natural mm-hmm. notes. So C would be red, D would be orange, E would be mm-hmm. yellow, F would be whatever. What comes after yellow? Green?
Green,
blue, you know. Blue. So he just went through the scale and went through the rainbow and associated pitch with the color spectrum. That's right. Represented and I guess, in the rainbow.
And I guess that was a skill that was prevalent in his era, mm-hmm. in his day. I mean, I'm thinking of it, maybe only those seven notes were available during 3,000 years ago, possibly. But at any rate, in modern music, we use 12 tones.
I mean, I know consonants was honored back in that music, you know, like you wanted mm-hmm. consonants. You didn't want a lot of dissonance. Dissonance was only to lead mm-hmm. to more consonants. So if you're dealing with just a major scale, this I'm just totally shooting from the hip. I have no idea what I'm talking about, but it's an idea.
But you are, because then the modes that come from the scale. You have the right. seven modes.
Right.
And it's still the key of C.
Yes. So I'm actually going to try to look this up if I can figure out how to spell Pythagoras.
P-Y-T-H.
Oh, I was way off. There's a Y?
Pythag. P-Y-T-H-A-G-O-R-A-S. I think I'm guessing. If I look at a document, I might be able to come up with something. Let me see. I believe that's it. I mentioned it. I talked about it enough. I should know. I mean, I had to go back. When I first started this, I had my own colors. I hadn't even thought about Pythagoras. I said, I'm going to come up with 12 colors.
Oh, really?
And ironically, when I checked out what he did, I said, oh, gee, we got the same colors. And I said, wait a minute. Let me just, you know, instead of writing the book all over completely, let me just piggyback on what he did and go from there.
Oh, man, I just found a really cool website. I just found a really cool website. I'll text this to you. This is like the whole breakdown of his thing. I'm sure you've read it.
No, maybe I haven't. You'd be surprised what I haven't read. I've always gone on my own, and then I'll dovetail later.
Yeah, this is okay. This is pretty deep. I'll include this in the show notes so everybody listening to the podcast cool. can check this out too. This is
great.
I mean, I'm just skimming it right now, so I hope it's as good as I think it is. But it looks pretty solid. And we've also talked about solar energy and you doing the work with music and color that it's, I think, a great way to introduce music to different, you know, people of ages, like really young children. I think that's a great way to introduce music to them. If they were to pursue it into like a collegiate level or a higher academic level, mm-hmm. sure, then you can deal with that, the terms mm-hmm. and things. You know, I've been doing the classes and workshops for special needs folks. I think this is a great way to start talking to them about what they're hearing and what they're feeling, and not necessarily talking about scales and things that are more academic. You know,
yes.
We're just talking
yes.
about the raw humanity and connection mm-hmm. with it. I think it's mm-hmm. I think it's a really cool thing.
I mean, I've seen have so much the joy on people's faces. I've seen doing workshops. I did a workshop with a group of blind people, and they were so engaged just to talk about, you know, red shoes and yellow cars and just imagining and then having them express that.
Oh, wow.
And tell a story about that and create a story based upon the color red. Well, we had red shoes going down to the red house, going up to the red barn, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It's it was just amazing to see how engaged they became. And they actually then when they started hearing the tones going along with the colors, it really was very exciting for them to know that they, hey, they made this. They made this story happen.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. That's cool, man.
Very cool.
We'll be back right after this.
All right, folks. All right. I'm doing a new thing. I'm offering up the middle of the show, right? The middle of the episode. I'm offering it up to you. That's right. If you have a new single out, you got a new album out, if you would simply like to get heard by the bass community, if you give a shout out to your social media handles, you know, your Spotify page, whatever it may be, hit me up. Stop by thebassshed.com and get featured on the Bass Shed podcast. And while I'm waiting for you guys to hit me up, I'm going to take this time to remind you about the Jerry Jamont Masterclass and book signing event this coming Saturday at the Bass Exchange Amp Shop in North Hollywood from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. You can see the footage of the previous masterclass that was held at Lemur Music on September 27th. Stop by thebassshedacademy.org and I have it all there under masterclasses. Check it out.
Excellent, sir.
So you got the book. You got the book out. You're working on solar energy. What else? What else you got going on, man? You're a busy guy. You're a busy guy.
Well, I got to do a crowdfunding to get the software created to make this really a reality, as opposed to presently, you can actually play the game with your device. Go to the solarenergy.org website and play the game.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because we didn't actually bring in that part of it. There's an interactive quality to it.
Yes, yeah. You can actually play the game and compare, play any song, and have the website open and hit the wheel with the pointer, and it'll emit the sound of the color. And you can match that with the sound of the music that you're hearing. So, I mean, you might not get all the notes. Each song has many notes. Sometimes they're out of the key. Sometimes they're in the key. But you're going to pick out what sounds good to your ear mm-hmm. with what's going on musically. And say, oh, this color green sounds good with this song I'm playing. You know, whatever the song is, signed, sealed, and delivered.
Yeah.
This green sounds good. I know that's in the key of F. That's no matter where I agree with sounds good.
Yeah.
I picked a key, a song was key I knew.
Yeah.
But you can take any song. I mean, you can Google.
What about like minor tonalities? Like, for instance, perfect example, you played the bass line, Thrill is Gone, B minor. So that's a tritone away. Mm-hmm. The root is a tritone away from F, you know, signed, sealed, delivered. And then we have a minor tonality.
Yeah.
So how does the minor tonality shape the color?
Well, it's going to be a D. It's going to be still.
So you're all basing it off
minor
of the
way in that color.
Yeah, the relative major tonalities are the colors.
Yeah, you have the purple. No, you have the the minor will be the relative major would be gold.
Okay.
But the minor making that would be orange.
Okay.
So you're talking about B orange, a turquoise. Indigo being a B minor 7 chord.
Okay.
You look at it that way, as opposed to B major would be violet, gold. That would be the third. And then you have the fifth being turquoise, and the seventh being indigo.
Okay, so you're really stacking the colors as you would stack a chord then. Not like one chord doesn't have one color.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Okay, because
you give all the color that's in that chord, you can do.
Right. I mean, that makes sense because you if you have more complex harmony. Minor. Yeah. If you have more complex harmony in
you
this
got
system.
You're only 12.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
You got 12 colors. You got 12 tones to play with.
Right. Right. And you just kind of stack them like you would stack the chord.
Exactly. All you right. put them side by side. You can separate them. They can put them in different order, like inversions.
Yeah, yeah.
For instance, you don't have to stack them like, you know, in thirds. You can stack them as an inversion. You can do the same thing we do musically. You can have it in one register. You can have the bass playing one register, which we do. The guitar is playing in the middle register. The horn is playing in another register. You have 3-4 registers to work with, basically.
Right, and then the registers have to do with kind of the lightness or the darkness, the shade is, I guess, the better word. The
yes.
shade
so
of the
lighter,
color.
Lighter register.
Lighter register is
yes.
higher. Darker register is lower register is darker.
Mm-hmm.
I think
you can actually see the fact that what was going on.
Right. I think it'd be a cool experiment, man, to get like 4 pieces of like 12 by 12 canvas and paint a chord progression.
Mm-hmm.
So if you did like whatever, 2-5-1-6.
Okay.
You know, and you stack the colors and you just however you want to paint it on the thing. But like these are the colors of the D minor 7. Maybe you put a 9 in there. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And you have those colors like represented. And then so you have these 4 canvas paintings that are an actual chord progression. That'd be interesting to see.
Oh, certainly. And what shape would the colors be?
Right. I feel like that would be time signature, because I think of time signatures as shapes. You
yeah,
know, like
okay.
3 is round, like 5 is a little bit more elliptical, mm-hmm. 7 is kind of oval. Like that's how I
so
think.
So you can colorize the the traditional conventional system.
Yeah.
That's one way of looking at it. As far as making it into, I like the idea of making it into an art as opposed to making it manuscript, because that's a whole different thing.
Right.
But the idea of making, being inspired by this one chord with those colors, that would be, D minor would be orange, green, indigo, red. D minor 7 chord, right there.
Orange, green,
orange. Those 4 colors.
That's kind of a, like I wrote down those and I stacked those.
Colors.
I'm reading those colors right now as you would stack a chord. So like orange, green, indigo, red. That's kind of a, like an autumn kind of color. Like we're having this conversation in October. It's kind of an October.
Which is?
Color.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the D minor 7, October month. There you go. Everybody listen to
yes.
So What and Impressions all month long.
Right. Yeah. There you go.
Just get all your October
that's
out of the way.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Get all the October
that's
out of the way at once.
That's what I'm talking about. And as I was saying, there's a website that has, you can actually go on and put a song in. It'll tell you what key it's in. You
okay.
can Google it. What key what key is Autumn in New York in?
Mm-hmm.
If you just put those words, Autumn in New York, what key is Autumn in New York in? I'll do it right now.
And it tells
the original
manuscript key, or if you put in, like, you know, Sarah Vaughan singing it. I don't know if she did, but I'm sure she did.
No, it'll give you the original. It usually gives you the original key.
The copywritten key.
Okay, that's a good.
Yeah.
Exactly, the copywritten key.
Right.
But you can put in, now if you put in Google search, if you put in, Shazam would give you, recordings of it.
Yeah, they just give you like links to the MP3.
Yeah, the recording, original recording, but whichever one that usually it's the original recording.
Yeah, yeah.
And they use that for commercials also. But yeah, you can put in like Autumn in New York, and it'll tell you. Let me see this. Take a second here and do it myself since I'm saying it. What key is Autumn in New York? Key. Is Autumn in New York.
Man, that's a great song.
I love that song.
Yeah, that's a solid reference. Solid reference.
Up.
I love that tune. I gotta send
Autumn
you
New York.
I gotta send you this version of it. There's a singer in New York named Julia Dolison. And she did this record called Observatory. And a good friend of mine, Adam, in Phoenix, hit me to this record. And it's these super modern arrangements of standards. And she's got a really modern trio playing with her. And her version of Autumn in New York is just slamming. Like, I'll send that to you.
Mm.
Great
yeah,
version.
Yeah, please do. Mm. Just one of the songs I grew up playing. Now, let me see what the original key is. It says Autumn New York, standard sheet, F major.
F major, okay.
That's green.
That's green.
Okay, so just a starting point.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the sheet music. Standard Autumn New York, sheet music.
What's an A? What color is it?
Indigo.
An A? Indigo. So green.
What indigo. Color is the key of A?
No. I'm just the pitch.
It would be indigo. Oh, A is indigo.
Okay, so we have what is, and C is red. And E is yellow?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. Okay, so an F major 7 chord would be green, indigo, red, yellow.
Yes.
Okay. The red and the yellow are kind of autumny. You know, the indigo gives it like a mood. You know, green kind of grounds it. I don't know if that's an earth color, but it seems like it should be.
It's associated with the earth.
Yeah, yeah. I always feel like greens and browns.
It's also rainbow colors. I mean, it's, Now, brown is not a rainbow color, but the ground is something that we live with.
Yeah, but that's like an earth tone. Brown. Like, I feel like that's an earth tone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, it is.
I don't know. I don't know if we're talking about music or interior design anymore.
Well, that's how it happens. You can go into create your interior design based upon the song. What song did you reference? In D minor.
Oh no, I was just talking about what D minor. I was talking about So What or Impressions because they just both sit on D minor forever.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. This month you can do a room. Your hangout room could be Impressions.
Right.
You know, the other room could be So What, you know,
yeah.
or Autumn in New York,
right.
You know, you can basically, you know, dress or in design, environmental presence, feeling, mood.
Yeah, I'm kind of into
that. It's all there.
I'm into that.
It's all there. And we have the software to do this, to come up, to give you things that are related to it, just like that, a drop of the hat. It's a wonderful tune that, you know, it's entertainment. It's called edutainment.
You can
look at it that way. You know, it's because you're learning something and you're enjoying something at the same time.
Sure.
In the learning process.
Sure. Yeah, that's how.
There's so much involved in the cross referencing, and it makes people are happy when their brains are active. It's, you know, people resting around watching. You know, instead of watching and cutting and pasting and what they call that term. Yeah, cut and paste, sampling.
Yeah.
They can create a sample. You can create.
Yeah.
Put the mind together and create something.
Right.
You might be inspired by a sample, but then go ahead, and create something. Oh, that sample is yellow? We'll create something in yellow. Let that and go from there. What else is associated with yellow? Well, in yellow, you have a key. You're going to have yellow. You're going to have turquoise. You're going to have silver. You're going to have indigo. You're going to have purple. You're going to have brown, you're gonna have gold and yellow.
Yeah,
that's the gold. That's the yellow major scale. So it's just more than just yellow. Yellow has friends. Every key has
good
friends.
Good job, yellow. Good job, yellow. Way to be social.
So every key has friends that are outside of their key.
Sure.
So you want to incorporate their friends. That makes for a rich, you know, tapestry, just like people.
Yeah, it's a good hang.
We got friends that enrich our lives.
Right. You brought up sampling. I know when I spoke with Fred Thomas, like so many of his, who I know you know from New York, many of his bass lines were sampled. And that's actually something, you know, he's been struggling with, is making sure that he gets rights and blah, blah, blah. Have you ever heard of any of your bass lines being sampled, or were you told that any of your bass lines have been sampled?
Not really.
No?
Not really. I hear people sampling my style.
Well, sure. Sure.
No, I really haven't. I haven't had that fortune to be sampled or
misfortune.
I don't know. It's, people, you know. or misfortune. Yeah, right. You know, they might get paid.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Exactly. That was Fred's deal, right.
Yeah, okay. But James Brown, sure. My records were like, you know, it's funny. A lot of my records were about revolution and freedom, and those kind of records usually don't get much, much credence. They try to put them in the back burner.
Right, they don't, they don't get the same. I think the records you were a part of were, it was such a direct laser beam focus on the thing. I would actually let that. That's, I want to hear what you think about this too. I think James Brown's music was about the same, but his was like,
oh yeah,
cool. My freedom is let's just dance. Let's hang out. Let's party. That was his freedom. He didn't talk about the problems and then talk about the struggle. He's like, no, I don't want to talk about the problems. Let's just forget about it and have fun. And like, let's have this freedom that we can't have in our other life outside of this music right now. I mean, I think very different approaches. Like your work with Nina Simone, she's got a very straightforward, blunt, in-your-face approach to it. And James was... He's like, no, man, we all know what's happening, but let's just all get together and dance and have a good time.
Yes, he came. But he did come on board with When I'm Black and Proud.
Yep, yes, he did.
He did, you know, eventually everybody, you know.
I mean, he did all Black Caesar. He did all the music for that movie Black Caesar that I think, if I remember correctly, was the only record he won a Grammy for, I think. Or maybe, no, maybe the only one that went platinum. I don't think he ever won a Grammy.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
I forgot. I don't think it's the Payback.
I Feel Good didn't win a Grammy, huh?
I know, right? Right?
It's amazing.
There's so many. Anyways.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was just another approach to freedom. And at the masterclass, you spoke about working with Nina, and you talked about working with Aretha. And what were some of those sessions like? Because I think so many of the listeners are obviously curious to go through the time portal, you know, and hear about what some of those sessions were like.
Well, they were all like top class union sessions. Contracted and everything was like, you know, all the I's were dotted and T's across.
Yeah, like a union gig, right?
With the union gigs, and they were all well organized, well arranged, well produced. So it's very, it wasn't like a hunt and it wasn't like a search and find mission.
Right.
Like you go in some sessions. You can go in some master sessions like that where they will. Sure, we did that with B.B. King. We didn't know what we were going to do.
Right.
We just went in there and fooled around and came up with something, basically.
but that's what it just happened to be like his biggest hit.
That was the purpose.
Yeah.
To do something, to make something happen with the music. So nothing was scripted.
Mm-hmm.
No charts.
Now, this is actually a funny conversation. Not funny, but I found it fascinating. We were hanging out, and you played me the original recording of A Thrill Is Gone. I didn't know that there was... I thought BB was the original recording.
Yeah,
and
a lot of people did.
What was the gentleman's name? Harry something?
Roy Hawkins.
Not even close to Harry. Roy Hawkins.
You got the H.
Yeah.
1951, it was number 6 on Billboard for 6 weeks. Was that the Rascals? It got to number 6 on Billboard.
B.B. King's version.
No.
Roy Hawkins.
Roy Hawkins.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
In 1951.
51, now,
this is in Hollywood.
Okay.
B.B.'s in Memphis.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was a DJ.
B.B. King was a DJ in Memphis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Mississippi, wherever he was DJing, he was DJing.
And he was playing this Roy Hawkins version all the time on the radio.
He discovered it then.
Yeah.
He discovered it when it came out. It was a big hit.
Yeah.
Number 6 on Billboard.
Right.
1951. So he knew about it, and a lot of people knew about it, and he wanted to do something with it. Mm-hmm. And it took him, he told me this, like, 20 years after we recorded it in 1969, we're talking I went to see him at a gig where somewhere he was performing, blah, blah, blah. I would do that, you know, in later years. And he then told me the story about how he had been listening to this song for a number of years. And because the success we had in the summer of 69, he figured he'd bring it into the studio in the fall and see what we can do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. That was it.
So you had already
more than everything else.
You were already hip to the Roy Hawkins version, right? Like when he told
No, I never heard of that. No.
Okay. Okay.
Only he knew that.
Okay.
I didn't even know he wanted to change his music.
Yeah.
Until later on, I'm reading where he wanted. You know, he really wanted to change his music.
Mm-hmm.
And he called the right people. He called the right producer, the right contractor, the right music contractor. Called the right musicians. And we changed his music.
So he came up to New York to cut this session, or you went down to Memphis or wherever?
He came to New York.
Okay.
And he came to the Hit Factory.
Okay.
The notorious, legendary Hit Factory.
Was that Wexler's studio?
Pardon me?
Was that where Wexler was producing?
No, his buddy Jerry Ragavoy owned the Hit Factory.
Okay.
He had produced Big Maybell there. We recorded John Lee Hooker there. Mm. I recorded Lorraine Ellison, Irma Franklin, Howard Tate, a bunch of black artists would go in and out of that. It was like legendary.
Yeah.
That was one of the few black owned studios. And that wasn't black owned. It was just a very soulful place that was had a good vibe, good people.
Yeah.
And they were tight. Jerry Ragavoy and Jerry Wexler were tight. They were buddies.
Okay.
So there was a strong connection there. So that's where I did most of my starting work in the 66. That was my first like big, one of the major studios I ever recorded in was the Hit Factory.
What was your first?
I've been going there for a while.
What was your first session there?
I have no idea. I was in awe, you know, just being there and just, you know, I know it was dark. I don't remember the order,
mm-hmm.
you know, I kind of like, you know, but that was the place to go. That was one of the major exciting places to be because the musicians would be like, you have Billy Butler, Wally Richardson, Eric Gale, Carl Lynch, Herb LaVille, Jimmy Johnson, Bernard Purdy, Richard T, yeah. Paul Griffin. I mean, it's a star list of, you know,
they
black
list.
Musicians.
Yeah.
That, you know, rhythm section cats, you know, hitting hard. They've been there forever.
Yeah.
You know, in the horns, you have Hucklebuck Williams, Hucklebuck Henry, and Fat Jones. You have, those are the best musicians in town would be playing there.
Yeah. What
Snooky Young, Clark Terry, Babe Clark.
Yeah.
I mean, Carnet Brown. I'm just remembering musicians, the horn sections and string plays. Al Brown, Thurwood Clark, Harry Lukofsky. This is, you know, this the best.
Yeah.
They would come there to record.
what were some of the sessions where you show up to do it and in your mind you're like, I'm really doing this session with Aretha. I'm really doing this with Nina Simone. Or like, where you had to kind of like, you know, it was a surreal moment for you.
They were all surreal.
Yeah.
That's about everyone, you know, it's like, you know, I grew up listening to Nina Simone.
Sure.
As I got older, I discovered Aretha Franklin. So I was on her train when she was recording for Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
As a jazz artist. So, they were all surreal. Even B.B. King was like the most calmest session because I was more relaxed with him.
Okay.
I was uptight with, okay, Nina had to, you know, Aretha, I was a certain anxiety. But I was very relaxed with B.B. because once he opened his mouth and started singing, I realized he sounded just like Ray Chinnery, who was a Jamaican cat, who I would play with and funk up his music.
Okay.
And the drummer would be Leo Morris, Idris Muhammad, and Honey Boy Charles Otis. And these are New Orleans drummers.
Yeah.
So they were always funky. So we would always funk up Ray's Jamaican version of B.B. King's music.
Okay.
And we had fun, and he liked it. So as soon as BB saw this thing, and I said, oh, he sounds just like Ray.
Yeah.
And so my approach immediately was like, you know, do the same thing I did with Ray. Okay. So it was a very relaxed situation, and the drummer was Herb. He was very intuitive, one of my favorite drummers to play with. He's very expressive. He would just play drums naturally and make up a part, basically, based upon sounds and not be restricted by a particular beat or rhythm. He'd make up his own rhythms on the spot, or hear something and just learn how to play it. And that's like I would do. I hear, make up something, hear something, think about how to play it consistently and record it and then forget about it.
It's
gone, comes in, goes out.
One thing you and I did not talk about, but should have when we did the masterclass a couple weeks ago, is I want you to talk about the bass you brought to that masterclass, and then let's talk about why you chose that bass, because you and I've talked about it since, and I wish that I would have acknowledged it at the masterclass, and I didn't, but I wish we would have had that conversation there in front of the folks that attended.
That bass was given to me by my neighbor, who's I named it after his last child that was born. He'd been trying to play the bass, but he kept on having children. Mm-hmm. And finally, had to give it up. And the last bass...
Give up the kids or give up the bass?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm keeping the bass. I'm keeping the bass.
Well, he kept the bass, but he would never practice. He'd come over, I'd give him a lesson. And the last child he had, Dow passed away. It was a preemie.
Oh, no.
And they named it Justice.
Okay.
And I remember going to the wake for the child and seeing the stillborn child. And so I named the bass Justice. And
that's beautiful.
You know, and I had the bass worked on. It just seemed to be appropriate to do that.
Yeah.
And they have it, to keep it living, keep the kid, this name, the thought, just keep it perpetual motion, basically.
Yeah.
So that's why I put that bass in. It's, I enjoy it. It's light.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to play. I had it worked on it, you know, so it's in great shape. So I kind of like honoring his spirit and his... just what he represents in my life.
I love that. And I love that story. And I love that connection. I think we were all a little curious because the name on the headstock said Squire. And so we were all a little curious why the legendary Jerry Jamont is playing a Squire. Now, the backstory behind that is wonderful. I'm full support of all that. But... you know, bass players, that's what you do, right? You walk in, you see a dude with a bass. First thing you do, you know, if you know him, you say what's up. If you don't, maybe you introduce yourself. Second or third thing, you look right at the headstock. What's he playing? Huh? What's he playing? What's this guy working with? It's what we all do. What's this guy got? What's he got?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Now I know the name there. What mods did he do? Oh, you switched it out with those? We're all idiots. That's what we do.
It's cool.
So I think we all did that. Yeah. We all checked out the headstock and... we wanted to know what you were playing, and I got a couple messages after. You know, I posted some videos of that masterclass, and and everybody kind of had the same response, which was, Squire, huh? Interesting, but there's something to that.
Yes,
they all
is.
Said, like, you don't need the, you know, the super boutique bass or some bass that's completely modded out with all kinds of capacitors and stuff. The sound is in the hands, and you do what you do with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And my main Fender with an ESP neck. That's my my legendary bass that I play. I've made Jesus 19. That's the bass that's in the picture because that's my previous bass, 1968, was stolen.
Right.
Shortly after I recorded Think, I was working at A&R. I think I recorded the Rascals already. People Gotta Be Free. May, that would be May. And somewhere after that, I was working at A&R and had two sessions and went to lunch with the engineer, left the studio, left the bass in the control room. We went to lunch, came back. The bass was gone.
Inside job. You think it was personal?
I have no idea. Some kids were in there rehearsing. I noticed as we were walking out.
Okay.
The cellist from the previous session had his kid playing with his kids. His friends were in there as we were leaving. So I thought it was cool, but apparently it wasn't.
Apparently it was not.
And I was never able to, you know, you weren't there to see it happen, so you don't know what happened.
It's true.
But they rented me a bass. It's funny you say that. They rented me a bass from Carol Music for the next session. They couldn't get a jazz bass. I got a precision bass.
Yeah.
But the engineer was the one who said, "Jam, Jerry, you got the same sound." Because he had just engineered the previous session that was on.
Yeah.
And he really loved that bass because the signal was so hot. It wasn't as hot as my bass that was stolen, but I still got a good sound out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one who made note of that and let me know that it really wasn't about the bass. It was about what I put into the bass.
Right.
That one instance and having that same engineer from the 10 o'clock session, engineer the 2 o'clock session, tell me I got the same sound.
Yeah,
that was like validation, confirmation.
Yeah,
that,
especially
on
two very different sounding basses.
Yeah,
and a J to a P. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was the same engineer in the same studio.
I remember when we hung the first time. I asked you how the Jocko video came out because I was young when the first time I saw that, and I hadn't started like checking out old music. I think I just recently discovered Jocko not too long before picking up that tape. So how did the tape come? I kind of like this story. I remember you telling it to me. How did you and Jocko connect? And where was the tape shot? And what was that experience like?
Well, we connected. How we connected? It was through a mutual friend who I just met in Amsterdam, who was actually, he was from Suriname.
Mm-hmm.
It's a country in South America that was basically settled by Africans, and the Amazon Indians allowed them, they were escaped in slavery, allowed them to, gave them freedom in the jungles of the Amazon, where they actually able to establish their own country. Which actually was a Dutch, the Dutch had it. The country's called Suriname, but they were able to have their own village, basically in the jungle, and that's where Pablo came from. At any rate, and another musician, the piano player, who his friend, and the drummer. Come to think of it, it was three of them. Anyway, I was in Amsterdam with Amos Verhaven, and I met them somehow at a club. Basically, I was hanging out, and he told me that Jocko, he was a friend of Jocko, and Jocko wanted to meet me,
mm-hmm.
you know, my number. I said, sure, give him my number. So I gave him my number. This is like in 1982.
Okay.
81.
Okay. Now, what did you think? Obviously, you've heard of Jocko at this point. You've probably heard him play. Especially being in New York. Like, what was the first time you heard Jocko, and what was your impression about hearing him?
Oh, man. This somebody did. Somebody did the work.
Yeah.
Somebody put the work
That's
in.
Right. Yeah.
You know, he was playing stuff I had heard, stuff like I imagined going. You know, I played harmonics. You know, I messed around with harmonics.
Mm-hmm.
I messed around playing, you know, heads of songs, you know. But he put the time and work in. That's my first reaction.
Okay.
I mean, he went beyond the work.
Yeah.
I recognized it immediately. And the record was sent to me by Jimmy Tyrell.
Okay.
Who was vice president of Columbia Records. And Jimmy was a bass player who, he was the reigning king of studio when I came into the studio in 1965.
Yeah.
He was the man.
Okay.
Him, Chuck, Bob Babbitt, not Bob Babbitt, what's his name? Bob, I can't remember Bob's last name. But anyway, he was the cat. And eventually, us younger cats, me and Chuck, we were younger than him. I'm young, a lot younger than Chuck. He kind of phased out, and he moved up to executive position at Columbia Records.
Okay.
He worked his way up. And so he sends me this record in 1975, I guess it was.
Yeah, I think it, I think it came out in 74. So five makes sense.
When it came out, I got it in 5. I remember getting it in 5.
Or maybe it came out in 76. Hold on, let me. Now I'm getting my Jocko numbers dyslexic.
Right. Well, I know when I in 76 I was the 750th anniversary the independence 750th anniversary of that couldn't be 70. It must be 250th.
Right.
Or 200th anniversary of this country, basically, Independence Day, 1976.
Right.
I remember that being the June. I remember being February of that year, being them being homeless and finding a house. And that in that June, there was a big Buddha celebration going on that at that particular time.
Okay.
So I remember that year. But it was in February where I was living in Jimmy Smith's apartment. That's when I received. That's where I got the record.
Okay.
I was living on 95th Street, and Jimmy. I somehow he got found out where I was, and it came in the mail there.
Okay.
I always stayed in touch with the union, so I kept updating my address and telephone number with the union. So
right, that's how they could get in touch with you. Yeah.
I could always be found.
So, his record came out in 76. I looked it up. It's 76, not 74.
It was 76? Yeah. Okay. So that's where I was. That's what I was. He sent it to me pre-release.
Okay.
I don't know. I remember getting it around February of that year. It was, you know, he was before actually was released, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
I was blown away.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1979, I'm meeting Arlen Roth. He's telling me that Jocko did a interview for Guitar World magazine, and he credits me as being his inspiration. He quoted saying, "I'm just a poor imitation of Gerald Jamot."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Wow, okay." I said, "I can hear it. I heard it." You know?
Just to qualify, you can hear the influence, not that Jocko's a poor imitation. You can hear the influence. Yeah.
I heard it, you know, I heard it immediately. I said, yeah, I'm glad he's acknowledged it,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
It's cool, you know. And then I just went from there. There was no, I didn't think about it until I met Pablo in 81. He said, Jocko wants to meet me and blah, blah. And I gave him a number. He came to New York in 82, 83. And he came back in 84. And we recorded the video in 85 on 9th Avenue. That's the chronology of how we met and what took place.
And what was the bass? What was the bass you were playing in that video? Because I asked you about that bass. I remember.
I had a couple of basses because I had a Fender bass.
I mean, I know what he was playing. He had like a jazz bass with a P neck or something. But what was the bass you had
scroll
headstock?
I had my Rivera bass.
Rivera.
That was the fretless that he played.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Abe Rivera bass.
Okay.
Beautiful bass. That's the bass he played.
Yeah. That one of yours got stolen, right?
That got stolen. That got stolen. I was, you know, product of my environment at the time, my life I was living.
Mm.
You know, things happened and it got stolen.
Okay.
But I got it back. I got stolen, I think it was 89. I got it back in 95.
Where is it now?
Now it's in Maryland.
Okay.
It's in Maryland.
Then
Mumima has it.
Somebody you know has it?
Oh, yeah. I sold it. I got it back, I wasn't going to... it was in bad shape. It was really... I had to put frets back in it to stabilize the neck.
Okay.
They found it in a guitar in a store in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, interesting.
That's where it was discovered. And I called the PD here in New York, and they went and contacted Dallas police, and they went and got it. And they delivered it to me when I was living in Long Island.
I'm surprised that they put that much effort into a stolen bass.
Nam Yo Ho Renge Kyo.
Okay, yeah. Got you.
I tell you, I knew it would be found one day because it was too unique not to be found.
That's true.
And one of my students, Roger Moore, is that his name? It's Richard Moore. Anyway, he saw an advertising Bass Player magazine, one more Jocko bass found. That was the heading.
Okay.
He said, "Jerry, they found your bass," because he was studying with me when it was stolen during that period, and so he knew it was stolen. Blah blah. You know, he knew the story. So I pursued it and went to the police department, and they went and did their work. And ironically, when I had to file the papers, as they told me, I had originally filed the stolen, the police report was filed in the wrong precinct. So I couldn't find my original report that was stolen. But it was a manufactured one. And the sergeant who came down and who took my paperwork, his badge number was my birthday.
Oh, man.
1946. I said, hey, this is looking really good.
Yeah.
So all you guys do is give me a bill of sale and we'll take care of it.
Yeah.
That's all he wanted. It was a bill of sale. I called Abe. I just moved out to Long Island. Abe Rivera.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me a bill of sale for the parts, what he spent for parts to make the base. I presented that. I took it back to the police station. That was it.
Okay.
They went and got it.
Yeah. Killing.
Yeah, it was cool. It took about 3 months after they did that, but they still got it.
Cool, man. So you got the book out. You got Solar Energy, which is a nonprofit organization associating colors and pitches. And it's a learning thing. The interactive portion. When should we look out for the interactive portion? That's in development right now, correct?
It's been in development for a while. Yeah. I'm doing a crowdfunding thing probably starting next week or early November to push it to get the necessary funds to get it done.
Sure.
And right now, when I started in 1999, it was not affordable.
Right.
I knew it was going to be a challenge. And I was told what kind of, brain work it would take, what kind of size computers would take to do it. And this wasn't feasible back then.
Right.
But now it's done. It's on, like I can say, you can go to my website right now and play the game. And it's very level one form. The software will do everything that your brain does, basically, and do it for you, basically.
Sure.
It will create colors. It will create music in us with a certain mood and a certain tempo for a certain purpose based upon your commands, basically.
Nice.
That's something you could do on your own. Any musician can do on its own at present. But for someone who's not a musician, it's very entertaining. And it's very, for a musician, it's very entertaining also just to see the possibilities outside of your normal way of thinking.
Right.
Just based upon the challenge of doing something in pink and doing something in green and red and making that work.
Yeah.
the criteria. And when you're going to bring these colors in and how you're going to bring them in. Is it going to be a chord? Is it going to be a scale? Is it going to be a little lick?
Yeah.
It could be anything. So it's very interesting. So that's I'm looking excited about getting that done to making it available to the world.
Cool.
I'm hoping I'll get investors who are like-minded, who will see the value in this and will invest in it to get the software done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you, man. I'm with you. Jerry, thanks so much, man. Thanks for doing the podcast.
Thank you. Appreciate you have time, Brian. And your audience, have a great day.
All right. That was my talk with Mr. Jerry Jamont. Again, the masterclass is coming up this Saturday, December 16th, at the Base Exchange Amp Shop in North Hollywood, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. You can get tickets at thebaseshedacademy.org. Jerry and I are also, I'm not part of this. This is Jerry's thing. Jerry is putting together a list of his favorite bass lines that he's played over the years. Across the board with all the different artists he's played with. These are Jerry Jamont selected bass lines, and we are creating a transcription book that will be available at thebaseshedacademy.org. You can pre-order that. You can reserve your copy for that. You can email me with any questions. But that's going to be happening in the near future. I just have to have time to... Jerry sent me a list. He sent me the list, and I'm started working on the transcriptions. And so I just got to knock out the transcriptions, have him proof them, and then the book will be available if anybody is interested in learning from the legend, Mr. Jerry Jamont. Stop by thebaseshedacademy.org for more information about that book of Jerry Jamont transcriptions. All right, folks, that's all I got for this one. If you enjoy the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it, and I will catch you on the next one in a minute.